This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
They didn't break that, but they have pretty good access to those people.
She subconsciously mocks that lineage, but she's
so that's happening.
Okay. It seems like an incredible story here on many fronts.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
December 21st, 1987. Dear Donald, I did not see the program, but Mrs. Nixon told me that you were great on the Donahue Show. And as you can imagine, she is an expert on politics, and she predicts that whenever you decide to run for office, you will be a winner. With warm regards, sincerely, Richard Nixon. That's a letter from Richard Nixon to Donald Trump that the new president said he was going to hang in the White House. It's not hard to find parallels between the two men, particularly the hatred of the news media and the so-called elites. But maybe Nixon's blessing was not such a good omen for Trump, because the new administration right off the bat is engulfed by a scandal, inevitably nicknamed Russiagate, that's reminding a lot of commentators of Nixon's Watergate. The New Yorker's Amy Davidson talked about those parallels recently with one of Nixon's inner circle. John Dean was the White House counsel who advised Nixon, but eventually testified against him in the Watergate hearings. Since then, Dean has written extensively about politics and the presidency.
You've spent thousands of hours listening to and transcribing Nixon's secret White House recordings. Do you hear the echoes now when you hear Trump? He talks about himself rhetorically, would like to talk about himself as Ronald Reagan's heir. But in terms of his language, his style, how much is he Nixon's heir?
He is very much Nixon's heir. Like Nixon, you hear Trump speak in the third person. He hasn't started using, as Nixon did, the royal we, but he's approaching that. But he does talk about Trump as a persona that he refers to. I guess I see it most in the fact they both look for their enemies and hold great resentment towards those they perceive as their enemies. I would have thought we all learned a lesson from Nixon having enemies list and things of that nature, but it seems not. We see it playing out with this presidency.
What's the most corrosive part of being in a Nixonian environment? Is it the lies? Is it the problems with the rule of law? Is it just the sense of enemies everywhere? What you know, in your book, you describe it as a moral abyss. When you're in an atmosphere like that, what gets to you?
Well, at first when I went there and I decided to go to work for Nixon, I thought there was a new Nixon. And there was a new portrayal of Nixon. The old Tricky Dick had grown up and had matured into a statesman. When I got there, that seemed to be the case. His presidency was so tightly run that other than a handful of people in his inner circle, even his White House staff didn't know him. When I would go in with group sessions, as opposed to when I had later one-on-ones, I realized he was acting. He was portraying the way he wanted to be seen and putting on a little show for the staff and a lot of theater. I hear that on the tapes also.
When people talk about Nixon and Trump, they point to some similarities: vengefulness, signs of paranoia, a wounded resentment toward the elites. Are those parallels that resonate with you?
Very much so. What I see in Nixon and versus Trump in the two personalities is they're clearly both authoritarian personalities. Mm-hmm. But it's a huge difference in the way they do it. Nixon did it behind closed doors. On a 10-point scale, I'd put Nixon maybe somewhere between 6 and 7. I'd put Trump at a 10. He is a poster boy for an authoritarian personality.
This makes me think about a tweet that you posted recently about a story that the White House has denied, alleging that administration officials tried to get the FBI to push back on reports about Russian contacts. You tweeted, "I have expertise on this matter. Pushback on an FBI investigation of the White House is better known as a cover-up." Tell us a little bit more about that process, about how a cover-up happens and how it turns into something that's often said, you know, to be worse than the crime.
If there's any lesson from Watergate or from Iran-Contra or the Lewinsky affair, it is that if you don't have a problem, what you truly do is you say to the FBI or whomever, come in and talk to my staff. Hillary Clinton, that's what she did on Benghazi and on her email controversy about her server. She made her people available, and they all talked openly to the FBI, and there was nothing there. That isn't what's happening here on questions about whether the Trump campaign had relationships with the Russians, knowing they were trying to favor Trump in the election and hurt Hillary, or what happened in that interim between the election and the inauguration, where Flynn was dealing with the Russian ambassador. So if there's no problem with any of those, why not say to investigators, begin investigating? You're not going to find anything. They're just not taking that position. Rather, they're trying to knock down press reports that are getting the various whiffs of these investigations and putting them out there. That's just not the way you innocent people deal with these issues. I'm sorry.
How about the whole when a White House becomes consumed with the hunt for leakers, for who's talking to reporters? Give us a sense of just how unhealthy or healthy, from your perspective, that can be.
It's unhealthy. It's one of the lessons from Watergate is very clear. Nixon's problems emanated from his deep concern about leaks. They started early in his presidency. They started right out of his National Security Council, similar to what's happening with Trump. Nixon was dealing with problems in Vietnam. There is an interesting parallel in that Nixon had been accused during the campaign by Lyndon Johnson in 1968 of trying to interfere with Johnson's effort to settle the war in Vietnam. And indeed, just recently we found out that was true. He had, in fact. And that was something that he did a good job of covering up, at least during his lifetime. No one could ever corroborate it. But a historian recently found notes that Haldeman had made when Nixon was giving instructions on these very things to block Johnson's efforts. Anyway.
Do you see parallels between that idea of whether Nixon had contacts about the Paris negotiations and this whole question of members of the Trump administration having contacts with foreign governments before the election?
It's a very, very remarkable parallel, curious parallel. But Nixon successfully covered that up. But the leak issue that we were talking about, the concern for it, Nixon went over the top. He called the FBI, just as Trump has done, and pressed them to start investigating. And he wanted surveillance of the potential leakers. He had something like, I think, a total ultimately of 17 wiretaps placed on reporters, NSC staffers, and even his own speechwriters that were suspect. So what's interesting, they never found the leaker by doing all that, and seldom do you. I don't think Sean Spicer is going to find by looking at people's cell phones whether they've called the press or not.
Right.
But who knows?
Let me ask you about Trump's comment the other day about the judge who blocked that executive order being a so-called judge. One of the real dramas of Watergate was whether President Nixon was going to treat certain judges like so-called judges or if he would concede to their authority. What if Nixon had ultimately kept defying?
Well, that's a real serious what if. If he had defied the Supreme Court, he clearly would have been impeached just for that. But again, the court doesn't have the U.S. Army behind it, and the Congress doesn't either. So these are how you create very serious constitutional crises that can end a democracy. Now, I don't know about Trump. Here's a man who's been involved in litigation his entire business life. He has a sister who's a federal judge that is a good federal judge. And so he certainly knows the responsibilities and nature of being a federal judge, how particularly they can't defend themselves when they're attacked. So this is going to be a real test of Trump's personality and his governing. Frankly, I was a little encouraged that the fact that the media did have an impact on him and forced him to remove General Flynn as his national security advisor. That was just a steady momentum and drumbeat by the Fourth Estate to keep those issues alive, and finally he did what he had to do. And so he's showing a few soft spots.
I wonder how crucial the press was in reining in Nixon and what lessons we can draw from that when we're looking at the Trump presidency.
Well, in the press never cracked the Watergate story. They never really were in front of the investigation, and they wrote no stories that ever surprised us in the White House. They were, you know, way behind where the investigation was at any given point. What they did do is they kept it on the front page. They kept the pressure on the story, and they made it a big deal inside the Beltway.
You make it sound like one of the roles of the press is to keep pushing until the president reveals who he is.
I think that is one of their roles, yes.
John Dean, thank you so much for speaking with us and sharing your experience and your perspective.
Pleasure.
John Dean, who served President Nixon as White House counsel, speaking with my colleague Amy Davidson. Dean's most recent book from 2014 is The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It.
You know, it's a funny thing that I've never been challenged to a duel before. I guess that's what this is.
Yeah, well, not really.
Of course it is. And I like that. No holds barred, eh?
That's Frank Langella as Richard Nixon from the 2008 movie Frost Nixon. And I love that movie. And in a minute, we'll talk with its director, Ron Howard. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from the New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Okay, here's one for you. Child star and Oscar-winning film director, Nine Letters. You need a minute? You got it? Ron Howard. I'm pretty sure he's the only person with that particular biography. In my childhood, he was already huge on The Andy Griffith Show, and then he came along and he was Richie on Happy Days. Off the screen, Howard made his name as a big-time Hollywood director and producer behind an amazing run of good films, sometimes even terrific films, romantic comedies like Splash, family flicks like Parenthood, and serious drama like Frost Nixon, the kind of wide-range career that you rarely see in filmmakers these days. In 2002, Howard returned to TV with a vengeance as the narrator of Arrested Development, a cult hit and a favorite of mine that had a short run, but a huge influence on modern comedy. The frequent rumors about a reboot of that show were on my mind when I had a chance to talk with Ron Howard at the American Magazine Media Conference.
When do you start shooting Arrested Development again? Make some news.
Okay, well, I'm not allowed to make any news. I have to kind of say what I've been saying, which is everybody has an appetite to do it. Mitch Hurwitz is dreaming up stories. He's the creator and the genius behind the whole thing. And really, the question is, the cast has become such a collection of superstars, is can you actually find the period of time when everybody can be there?
To schedule it. Did you have any sense that show was going to turn into the cultural phenomenon that it did? Or did it seem like a kind of side project for you at the time?
I didn't know. It was very experimental. And in fact, it didn't work as a ratings getter on network because it was pretty new territory stylistically and tonally. All I knew was that there was a new kind of TV grammar mm-hmm. that I thought we could use for a family comedy.
How would you describe that? What does that mean?
It was a sort of reality TV based, a little bit what you were seeing on YouTube. And then I also felt like that if you could use a narrator and you could use flashbacks and all of these things, and actually I wanted to do interviews the way they do in The Office and Modern Family, and that didn't find its way into it. But I thought if you could do all that, you could get a kind of comedic density akin to what The Simpsons is able to generate, where it just kind of seems like chaos, but it all kind of comes together. On the one hand, it's about entirely self-serving, selfish people outside of the Jason Bateman character, maybe Michael Cera's character. But at the end of the day, it still sort of celebrates the possibility of love and connectivity. It's, can I find love? Am I worthy of love? If I'm not, is there a redemption story that would make me worthy of love?
The story you're always trying to get at? In other words, you what's the thread for you that makes a Ron Howard film Ron Howard film?
I love all kinds of movies and television shows. And as an actor growing up on television, as I did, particularly in that era of the 60s and 70s, it was, TV was meant to sort of retell the same story in more or less the same way with little right. little tweaks and new jokes and things like that. And so I knew when I began to feel I'd have a career and a lasting career as a director, that I could do the job of directing. And then the question was, what kinds of movies? The answer was as many, all of them.
As some of the people here are old enough to remember, but probably very few, I remember it like it was yesterday, when you were 5, 6, and 7 years old,
yeah.
you were a star of the Andy Griffith Show. Apparently, Andy Griffith was on it as well, but you were the star as far as I'm concerned, and Aunt Bee was awesome. TV is a very collaborative form. Were you able, as a 5, 6, 7-year-old, to participate, collaborate, or were you merely an instrument of everybody else's vision?
Well, I think in everybody's mind, I was an instrument. Right. In my mind, I was in there.
Yeah.
I was a part of it.
You were Marlon Brando.
I was very lucky. We would do these read-throughs on Thursdays, and the cast was allowed to stay around for a half an hour and just comment. So Don Knotts would talk about jokes, and everybody was allowed to. And I was allowed to stay and listen. And that first year, when I was 6 years old, once or twice, I actually raised a point. And there was, just dead silence. No one cared about my ideas at all. And it annoyed me that they weren't really listening. And I remember very vividly the second episode of the second season, and I had just turned 7. I had done Music Man in the off season, was feeling pretty good about myself, obviously. It was a rehearsal, no wardrobe or anything yet. And I opened the door at the sheriff's office, and Andy was over on the other side, and Otis the drunk was in the jail cell, and Barney was over here looking for his bullet or something. And I did what I always did, was say, "Hey, Paul," and then go into whatever my line was supposed to be. But I remember stopping and saying to the director, I don't think a kid would say it that way. And they said, "Well, how do you think a kid would say it?" And I sort of pitched my little rewrite. And he said, "Okay, good, say it that way." And I remember being so gratified by that, feeling that I was a part of something, a part of a process. I mean, it was so rewarding. And I had to have been smiling because Andy said from across the set, "What are you grinning at, youngin'?" He actually would talk that way.
Really? Just like my house.
And I said, "Well, that's the first idea of mine that you've said yes to." And there was a little pause, and he said, "Well, it was the first one that was any damn good. Now let's rehearse the scene." So I was blessed.
Andy Griffith was kind of abusive, wasn't he?
He was great. And I was blessed to be around this problem solving. So, the themes weren't changing, the big ideas were in place, the tone was there, but there was this endless tweaking, refining, understanding, and trying to find this spot where things felt natural and yet, they were funny. And I also taught about, all about comedy timing and things like that that wound up being very useful. But mostly what I learned about is that you can have a lot of fun on a set, there can be a lot of laughs, but you need to know the story you're telling. In fact, as a director and a producer, what I try to do more than anything is just create an environment where I am sort of the keeper of the story. I have the final word, but I love the spirit of collaboration. I love creating an environment where I feel like talented people in front of and behind the camera can really excel. And it is about an ongoing conversation as to what else we can do to give this dimension and to give it depth and also give it currency. What makes popular entertainment really work is that it does have to have some relevancy.
Well, I think we've been very disciplined in not discussing politics for a full 15 or so minutes, but I would like to run a clip of a political movie that you made some time ago. This is from Frost Nixon.
"Mr. President, now you've always maintained that you knew nothing about any of this until March 21st. But in February, your personal lawyer came to Washington to start the raising of $219,000 of hush money to be paid to the burglars. Now, do you seriously expect us to believe that you had no knowledge of that?"
"None. I believe the money was for humanitarian purposes, to help disadvantaged people with their defenses."
"Well, it was being delivered on the tops of phone booths with aliases and at airports by people with gloves on. That's not normally the way lawyers' fees are delivered."
"Look, I have made statements to this effect before. All that was Haldeman and Ehrlichman's business. I knew nothing. Okay, fine. Fine. You made a conclusion there. I stated my view. Now let's move on. Let's get on with the rest of it."
Haldeman and Ehrlichman were the ones really responsible. When you subsequently found out about it, Why didn't you call the police and have them arrested? Isn't that just a cover-up of another kind?
Well, maybe I should have done that. Maybe I should have just called the feds into my office and said, hey, there's the two men. Haul them down to the dock, fingerprint them, and then throw them in the can. I'm not made that way. These men, Haldeman, Ehrlichman, I knew their families. I knew them since they were just kids. Oh, yeah, but you know, politically, the pressure on me to let them go, that became overwhelming. So I did it. I cut off one arm, then I cut off the other, and I'm not a good butcher. And I have always maintained what they were doing, what we were all doing, was not criminal. Look, when you're in office, you gotta do a lot of things sometimes that are not always, in the strictest sense of the law, legal. But you do them because they're in the greater interests of the nation.
Right, wait, just so I understand correctly. Are you really saying that in certain situations, the president can decide whether it's in the best interests of the nation and then do something illegal?
I'm saying that when the president does it, that means it's not illegal.
I'm sorry?
That's what I believe.
Now,
what's old gets new again?
Yeah. The Trump presidency is already in the courts. The Trump presidency is also challenging the status of the news media, of the arts, of truth itself. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine making a Donald Trump movie? I didn't mean to ruin your day.
I hope it turns out to be a Broadway musical comedy and not an American tragedy. As a storyteller, it's a very interesting time. You know, I mean, it gets back to that idea of popular entertainment needing to speak to audiences today and also often addressing fears. Mm-hmm. Even if it's lighthearted, even if it's comedic, you know, you need to be sort of hitting those buttons and those places where anxiety, you know, exists. And I think it's going to be very interesting to see, because in this period where niche programming works in a lot of ways, you can speak to a direct audience, whether it's movies or
TV. But that's not your thing. Your thing is to reach not a red audience or a hard red audience or a hard blue audience. Your thing, as I interpret it, forgive me if I'm stretching the point, is to reach a purple audience, to reach in an emotional, visceral, but also mindful way,
yeah,
a very, very broad, maximal audience, which is an old-fashioned idea in a certain way. Can it be done when the subject is political?
Well, the subject doesn't have to be overtly political to be political. I mean, there are storytellers that feel like everything you ever say is in some way political. But it is a very interesting time in that way, and I do think there's going to be a kind of a pressure or a yearning from audiences to sort of look at the polar opposites, portray that in some way that's relatable, but also talk about the possibility of this sort of coming together. And what does purple art look like? What does a purple existence look like? Is there something in there? So I don't know I don't have the answers of the show or the movie, but I can just sense that there's a question looming. And I also think there's going to be a kind of magnetic pull from a lot of people to sort of say, acknowledge the reality of the differences that people feel, mm-hmm, and then suggest the possibility of common ground and how can we either have fun with that, you know, or explore it. I think there's going to be a real urgency to try to be in the moment in some compelling, interesting, provocative way.
I know you have a long conference, so I want to end on time. I want to thank Ron Howard for your work and for your presence here today. Thanks so much.
Pleasure. Thanks very much.
Producer, director, and child star, Ron Howard. I'm David Remnick, and this is the New Yorker Radio Hour. If movies have lost some of the massive audience that they once had in that singular place in our imaginations they did when Ron Howard and I were kids, the culprit, or one of the culprits, might be video games. Games like Eve Online, which is set in outer space. In Eve, the spaceships look awesome, and the politics are really strange and complicated. And instead of just watching it like Star Wars, you're piloting the spaceships and fighting the battles alongside players around the globe. More than 500,000 people were playing Eve Online,
as of a few years ago. Simon Parkin writes a lot for The New Yorker about technology and gaming, and he's got this story for us about a political uprising that took place in Eve. It may be a galaxy far, far away, but it somehow sounds all too similar to planet Earth, circa right now.
So throughout history, there are moments when a group of upstarts enters the frame. They start out as a laughingstock, then they become a nuisance, and by the time those in power start to take them seriously, it's too late. Everything's changed. Sometimes the revolution takes place on the battlefield, sometimes it takes place in the courtroom, and sometimes the world is upturned right there in the claustrophobic voting booth. In 2007, a revolution took place on the internet, and it was started not by a king or a general, but by a mechanic called John. I spoke to John Boucher via Skype from his home in Canada.
Hello.
In 2006, when he was still in high school, he found an ad for a video game called EVE Online.
There was a lot to understand that I didn't really get, I guess, at the start. So, yeah, it just kind of clicked, and then I played probably solidly for maybe 5 years.
EVE Online is a massively multiplayer online game, which is commonly abbreviated to an MMO, which is a terrible name for a genre, but it's what we're lumbered with. It's set in space. People are given a spaceship when they first show up, and they fall into groups and have to collaborate or compete for territory. They have to mine resources. They battle one another.
Keep bubbling. Keep bubbling and keep bumping.
What EVE does have that kind of marks it out and makes it really interesting is that there aren't really any structured rules in the way that we normally encounter them in video games.
I want you by strike. Someone who can get me a weapon on strike, do it.
So normally you play a video game and it says, go here, do this, you know, find the enchanted sword and deliver it to this dude in this town or whatever. By contrast, in EVE Online, you decide what you want to do, you decide how you're going to do it, you decide whom you do it with.
Let's go. Go, 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 go.
Perpello and an eagle is shooting your dictator. Perpello and an eagle.
All right, I want Perpello jammed, dampened, dead. Kill Perpello. He's killed
EVE even has its own historian. His name is Andrew Gruen.
EVE Online has been an interesting case because it's almost a petri dish where you can prove if you put a bunch of human beings together in a space, they will self-organize in much the way they have in human history.
If you want to get anything important done in EVE, you'll want to join a group of like-minded people. So John Boucher went looking for a crew to fly with.
I was always into alliance warfare and, like, you know, be able to conquer space. It sounded really cool, you know, like, I ended up part of another alliance, which was kind of like what Band of Brothers would call their pet alliances.
Band of Brothers, which is sometimes called BOB, which is, by the way, another terrible acronym, was one of the largest and most venerable corporations in EVE.
As you can see, we're killing it as fast as it can be killed. All the good guys are on grid. Local is, what, 1,174?
So Band of Brothers was an elite corporation, the alliance with the best ships, the most skilled pilots.
Okay, we'll get a little bit closer. Everyone, orbit Charlie at 2,500. Burn your prop mods on, prop mods on, prop mods on.
What was it like when you first got your chance to play with those guys?
It was cool to see, like, the game celebrities you'd see leading the fleets where before you'd just seen them on the forums or something like that.
Band of Brothers expected their members to respect both the corporation and the game. They had to be dedicated and to be loyal, and they had to be available to fly missions any time of the day or night.
They had what's called alarm clock ops, where they want to do an attack at like 4 a.m. So they try to get everybody to set their alarms and play before work or whatever, stuff like that. And people would do it. I would do it.
Yeah.
Which,
yeah,
looking back on it, I'm like, that was ridiculous. Why was I doing that?
So John was still basically a kid. He was able to show up for the Band of Brothers operations. It didn't take long for John to rise all the way through the ranks, to the very top, to the directorship of Band of Brothers. In EVE, he was a high-ranking member of the elite. In real life, John had graduated high school, dropped out of college, and was considering joining the Air Force.
I had no idea what I wanted to do, but just get caught up in this, like, internet war against another faction.
Enter the goons.
Goons, goons, something awful, something awful, something.
The Goons came to Eve in 2005. They're a group of players that traces its roots to a website called somethingawful.com. Somethingawful.com is a kind of dark humor website with a hugely active and popular forum. Here's our historian, Andrew Gruen.
It tends to be populated by people who, you know, they like brash jokes, not politically correct, things like that. That's the kind of people that you're talking about. They don't like seeing people take games too seriously. A lot of the main traits of Goons from Something Awful at this time was we want to have fun with these games. We don't want to see these people who are, you know, total nerds pretending that they're space dictators and acting like Winston Churchill, which was something that you see a lot in early EVE Online history.
We would advertise the fact that our ships cost less than the ammunition of our opponent's ships and that we were still going to ruin their day.
This is Alex Gianturco. Alex was part of the first wave of Goons to come to EVE from Something Awful.
The more that we would do this sort of thing, the more Goons would join, the more power we got, and then we started.
What they realized was that if they had enough pilots, it didn't matter if those pilots had no experience. They could overwhelm the enemy through sheer force of numbers.
Well, we were able to completely overthrow the status quo of a massive online game in a galaxy where you had more players in one server than in any other game that exists on the internet.
Swarming enemies was how the new group got its name. Goon Swarm.
The great Goon Swarm nation will live through the ages, the dream of its people.
This is Goon Swarm's national anthem. The Goons are as bonded by common interests and goals as any real-world political faction, though they're hardly democratic.
Long live our newbies and rifters and the strong.
Most of the stable organizations in EVE Online, amusingly enough, are autocracies. There's a dictator in charge, the CEO or the alliance leader. People like strong dictators. People like strong leadership.
And Alex Gianturco fast became one of the leaders. Thanks to their sheer numbers, their loyalty, and this strong hand guiding them, Goon Swarm started to conquer territory.
Oh God, God.
He's going down.
I want to kill him.
Kill that pod. Kill that pod.
As the Goon Empire expanded, so too did the influence of Goon culture in EVE. Here's Andrew Gruen.
You know, in a very short period of time, you start to see people go from assuming you're supposed to act in that sort of space dictator way that Band of Brothers did, and they start assuming you're supposed to act a little bit more like Goon Swarm. And I think that a lot of people don't like that the culture changed and they want to go back to that old way.
Band of Brothers was one of the groups that wanted to go back. They were perfectly happy with an EVE that privileged their wealth and their experience. As far as Band of Brothers was concerned, Goon Swarm was, let's say, deplorable. And as far as Goon Swarm was concerned, Band of Brothers was a corrupt elite class of insiders who had monopolized power and they didn't care about the average player. And they were kind of earnest and boring to boot. Goon Swarm wanted to drain the swamp.
We exist as an entropic collective, a beautiful, perfect chaos.
For this,
we have become a target of fear by those who do not understand the poetry of our actions. Every speck of ash
floating amidst the cosmos
is another thread woven in the tapestry of our atrocities. Every cry of suffering and frustration is another song in our symphony of terror. New Eden will burn, and it will do so by your hand.
You're listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour. Today, Simon Parkin is bringing the story of a war that was fought in a video game, EVE Online, with tens of thousands of people playing. Two factions of rival players went against each other, the insiders, traditionalists who spent a lot of time playing and dominated the game, and the upstarts who wanted to shake up the old order. Our story continues.
Band of Brothers said that we were a cancer on EVE. And they were the strongest power block in the game. So essentially the Alpha Dog told all of the other power blocks that they needed to side with Band of Brothers and come after us. So July of 2006, the Great War begins.
The Great War. On one side, Banner Brothers, the elite corporation and its allies. On the other side, Goon Swarm. And as historian Andrew Gruen recalls, Goon Swarm took some familiar steps to attack the establishment. First, find backup.
An alliance with the Russian faction.
Next, solidify your support.
Unite all of the other groups in the game against Band of Brothers.
Finally, wage a propaganda war.
Goon Swarm worked really hard to make sure that this scandal never went away.
It was a multi-year, multi-platform attack on Band of Brothers, and Goon Swarm succeeded in, well, not really accomplishing much. By 2009, the war was at a stalemate. What could turn the tide? Who could bring about ultimate domination for the goons? Where was a hero for such a time?
I was kind of like maybe a little bored with what I had been doing.
John Boucher had been playing with Band of Brothers for a while by now. He wasn't having a great time. He was kind of bored with the way that they played the game, the earnestness, the grueling schedule.
Like, it felt like a full-time job to play with them.
John just wanted to have a bit of fun in space, so he adopted an alias and started playing beginner missions, just flying spaceships, with none of the responsibilities of being a director. And wouldn't you know it, John got himself recruited by Goon Swarm. Our goon friend, Alex Gianturco, remembers it well.
Actually, my attorney had recruited somebody as a scam.
Do you mean attorney in the game or attorney outside the game?
Attorney outside the game. I'm an attorney by trade, and the joke about Goon Swarm is that its nickname is Lawyer Swarm.
So your friend and attorney has targeted the Banner Brothers executive and convinced him to join your spy agency. Is that right?
I wish it was that targeted. It's a funny old thing. And it comes time for my friend to execute this scam. And the guy says, well, you know, I've had more fun playing with Goon Swarm for the last 3 days than I have had in years being a director in Band of Brothers. And I like you guys. Please don't kick me out.
It was kind of just more fun laid back, and it felt like a game.
Gianturco and the rest of the goons tried to figure out how to use their new spy.
Finally, it hits me in a flash of intuition that he could shut down Band of Brothers, removing the Alliance from the game.
I was just looking at stuff to steal, to be honest. And then I found a button saying, you can disband them. And I'm like, oh, that would be interesting.
Was there ever, you know, any hesitation from you? You know, were you immediately like, this is what I want to do?
There wasn't any hesitation. I kind of, I thought it'd be hilarious. When I hit this band, people were losing their mind, trying to find out what had just happened. And I don't know, there's all kinds of speculation. They're calling people on their phones to wake them up, like, to figure out what's going on. And it was nuts.
Did you ever hear from any of them again?
Oh, yeah. I got death threats from some guys. People were talking about going to my boss, like calling my bosses at work. I don't know what they'd say. Oh, this guy stole my spaceship in a video game. Like,
now, if you don't play video games, you might chuckle at people taking all of this so seriously. But imagine it's your hobby. You've spent 1,000 hours across 5 years creating something incredible, like the most amazing model railway, a vintage Harley that you rebuilt from scratch, or the most beautiful sweater ever knitted. And then someone comes along and they say it's boring, and then they pull it apart and they set it on fire. That's what John Boucher did, and the goons loved him for it. Here they are on a group chat online the next day. As for the former members of Banner Brothers, well, even in victory, the goons had proven themselves deplorable. Here's a Banner Brothers spokesman on an Eve radio show the day after the disbanding.
It's not proper, is it? It's not really. I've planned to do this for the last 8 months. I've spent 8 months of my life talking to people that I didn't really like and that I wanted to screw over. This is, God, I don't really like this. I fancy a change. Actually, no, I'm going to lose all my stuff if I don't do something about this, because I've actually joined a corp that was going to scam me.
Honourable or not, elegant or not, deplorable or not, The Goon Swarm was victorious.
Is conquering invaders and returns to our homeland. The crew are of thee, our glory.
Victory in the Great War was great for Goon Swarm, but it didn't do much for John Boucher, the man who'd made it all happen.
We gave him a mothership, which is a super capital class vessel, in return for his service.
And that kind of sucked the life out of the game for me. You're stuck in this huge, really expensive ship, and people want to kill it. So I would log on, and I would just like hide around a force field, or in a force field, just to, so I'm not getting attacked. And eventually I sold that, but I didn't want to fall into it being like a job again. I kind of wanted to do other stuff.
So you were kind of a victim of your own success, really.
I guess you could say that.
I think the most interesting thing about EVE Online is the way that it shows us when we're presented with this fresh galaxy where we can be whoever we want to be, where we can do whatever we want to do, we can organize however we want to. What we find happens is we tend to fall back into our old ways. We just do all the same things that humans have been doing throughout history. We organize into factions. We create self-serving alliances. We follow charismatic leaders who say the things we want to hear.
It obviously like reminds me of what's going on at the moment, you know, perhaps with things like the US election. You know, is that overstating things to say that you can see things mirrored?
EVE is a dark mirror of humanity as a whole, not merely in the political level. EVE teaches you things about how people behave that most people are protected from. I've seen some really sort of searing unpleasantness. I wish I could say something wonderful about how EVE shows us that there is hope and that there is a better side to human nature. It's very Hobbesian, though, and EVE reflects in many ways what humans are like in a position of insecurity. Human nature, when it is under threat, and in EVE your assets are always under threat, is a very different thing from, I think, what we would want it to be from a liberal democratic perspective.
That's Alex Gianturco. New Yorker contributor Simon Parkin is the author of Death by Video Game: Danger, Pleasure, and Obsession on the Virtual Frontline. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Now, we spent a lot of time this hour in the virtual world of entertainment, movies and video games. I think it's time now to get back to the real world, the all-too-real, all-too-messy world. Jonathan Franzen you probably know as one of America's greatest novelists. And he's also written some terrific essays for The New Yorker about
conservation and nature. He's a huge bird watcher, all the more so since he moved to the California coast. Recently, we asked Jonathan to take us to his favorite place to go birding, and he drove out there with the Radio Hour's Rhiannon Corby. But it wasn't quite as picturesque as you'd imagine.
We are driving into Moonglow Dairy on a dirt road, which thankfully is dry. When it rains here, it can be basically just an ocean of manure and a bird just flew across. That was a western meadowlark, one of my favorite birds, but I say that about almost every bird, so I can't be trusted. Huge power lines overhead, so we're painting a picture of a pretty industrial-feeling place. There's a power plant down less than a mile away at Moss Landing. We just went underneath, like, about 100 high-tension wires. I'm just going to park here.
My God, the sound.
I should have brought some binoculars for you.
We're about a half hour south of Santa Cruz, about halfway down Monterey Bay, which is a glorious, deep ocean bay known for its spectacular wealth of all kinds of life, particularly whales, octopuses, and seabirds. And branching off that bay is this estuary, which we are approaching Elkhorn Slough. So Moonglow Dairy is on the edge of Elkhorn Slough. And we are in some of the richest and most intensely farmed agricultural land in North America here on the edge of Monterey Bay. And there's always high demand for manure, so the suspicion is that they make more money selling the manure than they do selling the milk. When I come here, I like to look for rails. And rails are very, very furtive, very narrow birds. The expression thin as a rail is not referring actually to a railroad track. It is referring to a bird because they look, when you look at them sideways, they look like chickens or something. But when you look at them head on, they're incredible. It's like a chicken that's been flattened. And that's to help them sneak around in reeds and tall grass.
Can you talk about how you got into birding? I want to get a sense of why you spend so much of your time doing it.
Oh, well, the short answer to the question of why do I bird, and here's how greater yellowlegs, can be answered simply by pointing a scope at almost any of these birds and saying, have a look. Aren't they beautiful? We're just standing here, basically, doing nothing, and naked eye, I'm seeing 20 species of bird, each of them beautiful in its own way. Look at that. Look at the Forster's Tern just did it. Is it going to do it again? Yep. Diving for little fish. There's always stuff going on, and you never know what you're going to find. And whatever you find, it's going to be beautiful. And the more interested you get, the more interesting it gets, because you start to learn what these birds need, what they like, what kind of habitat they like, what their requirements are. And at a certain point, you reach critical mass, and birds become just a way of understanding the physical nature of anywhere you happen to be standing. You can get a sense of what's happening to the natural world, what's happening in the natural world, by paying attention to this portal, which is these very visible, very beautiful, very intelligent bipeds who are kind of like us. See if if there's anything worth. Oh, we have a, there's a Bonaparte's Gaul. Wait, is that an Avocet? I think we have an Avocet here. Yes, American Avocet, which I'll zoom in on to see its wonderfully upcurved bill. It was only after I'd started to get some recognition for the writing that it became even an option to stop and enjoy myself, to do something just because it was fun, because it was pleasurable, to spend an entire day doing something just because it was pleasurable. That was inconceivable to me. But of course, I bring the same uncomfortable, obsessive personality to birding as I do to anything else. So I can get a little, you know, I can get very angry if I'm not seeing what I'm looking for. I can start to think, oh, this is not pleasure. This is an addiction. I can't leave it alone. I've got to go out. I've got to find a new bird. Bird watching is so grotesquely uncool. It's the last thing I need, something else to make me really uncool. I've written actually a lot about birds for The New Yorker. I keep trying to find new ways to slip it past David Remnick, who I really think couldn't care less about birds. Interesting, just flew there. I don't know what. There are a lot of flies. It smells bad. The light is fantastic. Lovely late afternoon January light. Oh, fantastic bird. Check this guy. Came out here for family reasons and at a certain point realized.
Oh my goodness.
That's all manure. Oh, that's annoying. Why I thought it was going. Looks firm. But these shoes are never gonna be the same. Well, I sort of, we were skirting the edge of a lake of manure and I was trying to cross a part that looked like it was solid, but that was just a crust on top, and now I've basically not only the entirety of the outside of my leather boots, but I fear the inside as well, not to mention my pants up past my ankles are coated with sort of liquid manure. The product of the hundreds of cows to our right.
Jonathan Franzen, who better to show us that pleasure comes with a messy price? We did offer to buy Jonathan a new pair of boots, but he said that after a careful hosing down and a coat of polish, you'd never know I stepped in it. That's it for this week, and thanks so much for listening. You can listen back to anything you've heard this hour or catch up on archives of the program at newyorkerradio.org. I'm David Remnick. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.